Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Stock market is in decline again. Economists can't agree on how aggressive the Fed should be with interest rates. And by some measures, the recovery from the last recession was, albeit lengthy, weak. Historically low unemployment, yes, but coupled with stagnant wages. We're talking about what happens when, not if, the next recession hits. Coming up, we'll hear from some economists on the issue. Right now, Greg Robb has been covering it for MarketWatch.com, where he is senior economics reporter. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Greg Robb.
Thanks for having me.
What are the factors when you consider the factors that you consider when writing about a potential recession at this point?
Well, I try to talk to as many people as I can to see if it's on their radar and if people at the Fed are worried about a recession. And I mean, it's still a very low risk here. I mean, I think that's important to stress right at the beginning.
It's a low risk here because you're saying because it's not on that many people's radar?
It's not. I mean, the economy is doing really well. If you look at the labor market, we have low unemployment. GDP has been strong. Inflation is kind of under control. So things are looking really good now. But what's happening is that for the first time, people are thinking that we've maybe hit a peak and that things are going to slow. Now the question is how slow. The Fed thinks that they can slow things down just a little bit, but the market seems to have less confidence in that, and they're getting a little bit worried.
There's a pretty common school of thought that recessions are cyclical, that they're inevitable, and the question is how bad can they get and how well can they be managed?
Yeah, I mean, right now the economy has been pretty strong for about 9 years, and in another year it's going to be the longest expansion we've had in modern history. So some people think, oh, well, there's got to be recession because economies, you know, it's been going on for a long time. But people have to remember the economy, you know, recoveries don't die of old age. So there is a path forward here that there won't be a recession. Just, I think you have to stress that. Now, there could be a recession. You know, it is a risk that is slowly creeping up into people's radar. But it's kind of, you know, that's where we are right now.
It has been a long, as you said, by next year, if it sustains, it'll be the longest expansion in history. But it's coupled with, as I mentioned, these pretty stagnant wages, not on the top end, but on the lower and middle ends.
Right. I mean, the economy definitely has some ills, but it's not something that the Fed can focus on that much. You know, the Fed can't get wages up and productivity to rise. Those are sort of embedded in the economy. But the longer that the recovery lasts, the higher wages are going to go. We think we see them picking up right now. So it's pretty, you know, things are pretty good right now in the trend heading that way.
Because unemployment is so low, employers are having to compete for workers.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that is, you know, we're going to get another number on Friday, and people are expecting wages to go up. They're about 3%. Of course, everybody would like to see them higher. I'm not saying that that's not the case, but they are moving in the right direction. And if the economy can keep growing, then I think workers will see higher pay.
The president has been criticizing the Federal Reserve for inching up the prime rate of interest. What about that? What about how the Fed is managing the interest rate?
Well, the Fed has been pretty easy with monetary policy. They've been raising rates, but pretty slowly and gradually. But the president, of course, you know, he thinks that it's better to, you know, pedal to the metal and to that would help the economy, but the Fed is really trying to. The Fed is trying to slow the economy down. They're just trying to slow it down a little bit, and the president really kind of has been pressing. He thinks that his tax cuts can help the economy, you know, sustain 3% growth rate for the foreseeable future. But most Fed officials aren't on board that.
Well, what about the tax cut? What do we know about what kind of impact that's had?
Well, the tax cut has boosted growth. We had over 4% growth in the second quarter, over 3% this past quarter. It has been a boost to the economy. There's kind of no question about it. Now, there's a debate among economists. People don't really know whether it's a sugar high or if it's going to be long lasting. Most people think are worried that it's going to be a short kind of boost. But other Fed officials that I talked to really think that in 2019 we'll see good growth because of the tax cut, and that the slowdown is a 2020 question.
Why the fears of it being a sugar high? Is it because where most of the tax cuts came from, those are people and entities that aren't going to go out and buy a new washer or a new new house next year? They already have everything they need, or what?
Yeah, that's what I mean. It was sort of like a windfall. And so people, you know, the Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and others argue that businesses would take this, you know, largesse and turn it into, you know, help their businesses. But it looks in a lot of cases that people didn't do that, and it hasn't really boosted in business investment. But it is still kind of early days on that. The jury is still out on that. We'll have to see as we go forward.
Derek Thompson at The Atlantic referred to the looming shadow of corporate debt. That was his quote. It's a quote from his recent article. And any uptick in interest rates on such debt affects corporate profit margins. So what kind of role does that play in all of this?
I mean, I think the Fed is really watching the financial system closely since the financial crisis. So I think that right now they think the risks of that are moderate. Obviously, when the higher interest rates go, the more people who have, you know, been speculative, mm-hmm. things get a little bit tougher for them. So, you know, it's hard to know. There could be these shadow pockets of bad kind of financial practices that'll turn around and bite us. That's mm-hmm. for sure.
You know, we know the stock market's been in decline. It took a hit in October. It's taking a hit again in early December. That's not in and of itself an indicator, even though the president used to, you know, back when it was doing well, would look at, you know, point to it as an indicator of good times. It's not necessarily an indicator of bad times ahead either. What do you make of what's going on right now?
I think the key metric that people are talking about in financial markets is the inverted yield curve, the bond market. There's a sense in the bond market that people don't want to hold longer-term paper and that investors are getting, you know, kind of scared about the future. That is a signal that's kind of given everybody a little bit of a pause. In the past, when the yield curves have inverted, a recession has followed, not like the next day, but sort mm-hmm. of down the road. So that is a really good, that is an indicator that people are watching carefully. There's a debate at the Fed about it, what to do. Should they pause? Should they, you know, wait and see what's happening, or should they go ahead with interest rates? It looks now that they're going to go ahead in December and then see how things shake out and see if they can get some more information from the data. The stock market for the Fed is a little bit more like a, you know, a casino. They don't take such a great signal from it. It's still up for the year. It's been really, you know, strong under the Trump administration. So they're a little bit less worried a bit about that. But of course, if it, you know, these steep drops that we had yesterday continue, that'll change really quickly. The Fed will not be so sanguine about things.
And of course, it's off today for the National Day of Mourning for George H.W. Bush.
That's right.
Charlotte and Columbus, you are on the air with MarketWatch.com senior economics reporter Greg Robb. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Good morning, all. I have a question. I've been hearing tales of this ballooning multi-trillion-dollar debt that we, the taxpayers, are floating in order to finance this tax refund or this tax abatement. And the other part of that is I have the impression that, for example, the People's Republic of China is holding a lot of our public scrip. And I'm wondering how much of that is playing into the skittishness of the market, because I know, I mean, if I came from a family that used to buy U.S. savings bonds for presents, I give cash now.
Hmm. Greg Robb?
Thanks for your question. I think that our debt situation is not a perilous situation. I mean, it's hard for people to wrap their heads around that, but I think we have money to spend. We have more money to spend. If there's a recession, I think that you could see Congress is going to come forward and spend even more money. It's obvious that we have to be mindful stewards of our financial system, but right now I would say that our financial health is not imperiled. It's true that China holds a lot of our debt. Our debt is being held around the world, and that is one of the things that makes our economy better, not better, but we have, it gives us a special place in the global economy. But so for now, the debt is not, I would say, one of the top three issues facing the economy.
You mentioned that the Congress, if it looks like it's necessary, Congress will come forward and spend more money to inject into the economy. But is there less flexibility because of that tax cut to do that?
Yes, obviously there's less flexibility. There's many people that were arguing that the Republicans should have held off from their tax cut because and save that money for a rainy day and or, you know, spend it on infrastructure programs. But I think when I talk to people, they think that there's still more fiscal space for the economy. And for the Fed, they would really hope that Congress would step up and try to combat another downturn, because for the Fed to do it on their own, as we saw during the financial crisis, it makes for a slow recovery.
And all right, so then right before the election, President Trump was talking about a middle class tax cut. That's different. That kind of injection into the economy is different than, say, Congress going out and going forward with maybe this infrastructure bill that they've been talking about for the last 2 years.
Right. That's what you were kind of talking about earlier, that if you give middle class people money or people that are struggling money, they're going to go out and spend it, and that'll give the economy a boost and hopefully get, you know, the more spending, then businesses have to go out and hire people, and you get this like virtual loop in the economy. That would be the idea of a middle class tax cut.
Yeah, but it's different. I mean, the effect on the economy when you do that is different than when, say, you put through a multi-billion dollar infrastructure bill that's going to create jobs and that kind of a thing.
That's right. Those are two different things. But I mean, you know, they're kind of pointing at the same direction. A tax cut for people would be more, you know, immediate. An infrastructure bill, that's when you're focusing on the economy. You're trying to put the framework in for the economy for like 25 years of growth.
You know, for many decades now, maybe not that many, but for a few decades now, we've been accustomed to a president that kind of plays it close to the vest when it comes with dealing with the economic factors out there, the stock market, the feds, that kind of a thing. This president's much different. Does that play a role in any of this? Does it have an effect on anything?
Obviously it has an effect. I mean, things are...
Emotionally, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I think substantially too. I mean, he's making life difficult for the Federal Reserve by criticizing them so much for raising interest rates. I mean, it puts them in a bind because they have to kind of appear independent and they have to kind of continue raising rates, which is the opposite of what he wants them to do. But so it kind of puts a lot of pressure on them. It's not helpful. Robert Rubin, who was Treasury Secretary for Clinton, he, you know, told Clinton that, you know, it just does not pay to criticize the Fed. It's a no-win situation. But, you know, Trump really feels that this is his home court. You know, this is what he knows more than anything. So, you know, he's going to say his opinion.
A big difference between now, if we want to say, if there's a suggestion even that a recession's on the horizon, and back in 2008, is the housing market, right?
Right. I mean, right now, one of the things that are showing signs of weakening is the housing market and auto sales.
Right.
But that's because, well, you know, interest rates have risen, mortgage rates are higher, and I think a lot of people in the housing market thought that the interest rates could rise and housing could stay okay, but really housing has fallen out of bed. So people are a little bit startled. It's early days to see whether this is a trend, or so we have to watch it carefully. But it's interesting how quickly higher interest rates have caused that downturn in the housing market.
Yeah.
Of course, we're far away from a 2008
right.
scenario.
Right, well, because there's just so many other factors involved in that. But yeah, it has taken a lot of caught a lot of people off guard as far as how the housing market has responded to the interest these relatively, you know, quarter percentage point increases. But is that more regional? We're not necessarily seeing that in Central Ohio per se.
I mean, housing market is obviously very, it's local. It's very, very local. So some different factors are different in Columbus than they are in Washington, D.C., and different cities. But overall, it's a surprise to people. You know, mortgage rates are about just 4%. For many of us, 4% mortgage rate is not the end of the world, but it seems to have really kind of stopped things in their tracks a little bit.
Greg Robb, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
I appreciate. I hope I had added some light and some knowledge to the situation.
You did. Thanks. That's Greg Robb. He is the senior economics reporter for MarketWatch.com. Coming up, we're going to hear from some economists on what they think about this as it affects Ohio in particular. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the prospects for the next recession, what happens when it hits. Are we ready? In Ohio, lawmakers vowed to retool the unemployment compensation system after it went kind of belly up in 2009 and was forced to repay more than $3 billion with a B dollars plus interest in loans from the federal government. Ohio legislative leaders vowed to retool the system, but so far, nothing. Joining us is senior project director at the Policy Matters Ohio. That's a liberal leaning think tank, Wendy Patton. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
And economist and owner of Regionomics LLC, Bill Lafayette. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me back, Ann.
So, Bill, how does a state's ability to keep the unemployment compensation afloat play a role in the severity of a recession going forward in Ohio?
Well, it allows people to spend on consumer goods, to spend on necessities. It is the safety net. And so if that goes away, you have people who can't afford basic necessities, who become homeless, who strain the systems of local governments, and you just have less wherewithal to support consumption to any extent at all.
That's a kind of a trickle down or trickle up or trickles
trickle
all over the place.
Yeah,
right. In a not a good way.
Yeah, not in a good way at all.
Wendy Patton, what do you make of the fact that the Ohio General Assembly has not achieved the goal of stabilizing the unemployment compensation fund in Ohio? Every state has its own. Some states have achieved this by lowering benefits, by lessening the length of the benefits, and also by increasing business contributions to it. Ohio hasn't been able to find a happy medium.
They haven't, Ann. It's like legislators are in a state of denial. Policy Matters Ohio has been at the center of this debate for the last decade. When the recession hit, we were talking to the Strickland administration, and we worked with Wayne Vroman, the leading expert on this, and brought ideas to the administration. At that time, the hemorrhage was already on. There was no fix taken. Since then, there has been a debate about solvency. And no one has, I think, come to conclusions. Dr. Vroman has found that we don't have a revenue system that's strong enough to support our needs, that we've kept the tax rate on employers far too low compared to other states, and that's at the heart of the problem. And we've not been able to move forward on that in the debate. Now, another problem with our unemployment compensation system is that it reflects an economy of the 1960s in which there are lots of well-paid construction and manufacturing jobs, and they're easy to get. we've got a different economy today. And today, many people don't earn enough or get enough hours to even be able to claim unemployment compensation. So when the recession hits, that huge component of our economy will be hit especially hard. We need to modernize our unemployment compensation system.
You were an executive assistant for economic development in the Strickland administration, and you told one of my producers that you remember the urgency around all the social services at the time when things went south in 2008.
Yes, it hit hard and fast, and there was a great deal of despair. We would encounter advocates in the halls of the State House who would recount very painful stories of people that they saw in county offices or in food banks. One of the biggest problems out there was that people who lost jobs suddenly didn't realize that there are safety net programs in place that can help them, their families, their communities, and even their employers. So outreach was a big thing. But I remember particularly the food banks were hit hard. People were scrambling. They didn't understand the supplemental nutritional program. Healthcare was a particularly difficult problem. Families with children with health needs would lose their homes in order to try to maintain health care for their children. So we saw deeper damage that was necessary. And I think especially with the Medicaid expansion, we go into the next recession, and there always is a next recession given the structure of our economy. We go in protected a bit by health care. And we know that the population, the residents of Ohio, know about the Medicaid expansion. They know about the federal exchanges. So that is a level of protection that we didn't have last time that will be very important for families and people.
And there are state-level macroeconomic forces that make things worse. I've looked at Ohio's employment trends, believe it or not, since 1939.
I believe you.
And in every recession since then, we've lost more jobs proportionally than the national average. The thing was that prior to the early 1970s, we'd make up for that with a greater than average increase in employment. But starting clear back in the early 70s, we fell further and we didn't come back as far. And so the economy is secularly shrinking. And so the pain that people feel in Ohio is worse than what people feel in other states.
And one of the reasons maybe that we're not coming back like we used to is we're shrinking as a manufacturing state.
Correct.
Those jobs, there are job replacements, but they're not at the level. They don't have the benefits. They don't have the pay and the reliability.
And machines and soon AI. AI is something that I'm kind of worried about.
Artificial intelligence and robotics, of course.
That
all part and parcel of the same thing. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the economy. Kind of in advance, 10 years ago, we were talking about the economy, too. And it was in dire straits, in a free fall. Things aren't like that now. But there are a lot of things in place that suggest that there's something to be considered in the next year or two. And it's not necessarily the stock market. Still with us, Bill Lafayette. He's an economist and owner of Regionomics, LLC. And Wendy Patton, Senior Project Director at Policy Matters Ohio. If you have a question or comment, we welcome your thoughts. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Bill Lafayette, two big things. Wendy Patton brought up one of them, which is health care. That's very different now for a lot of people. There's been the Medicaid expansion. There's the Affordable Care Act that, even though it isn't what it might have been or was, it's still there and it is very popular. And housing. We don't have the housing meltdown that we did then, although the housing market is slowing, and I do want to talk about that. But in general, those are two huge fundamental needs for humans is housing and health care.
Right.
And those are pretty stable right now compared to 10 years ago. Can that make a difference?
Oh, it certainly can make a difference. The problem, though, with health care is that it's not covering as many people as well as it did even a few years ago. And so that safety net is fraying a little bit. And we can talk about the housing market later, but I'm starting to get a little concerned about it.
Are you among those who are a little taken off guard by the effect of the Fed raising the interest rates?
No, I think the interest rate increases are a good thing.
Okay.
Both from the idea of economic stabilization and to give the Fed an essential tool in controlling.
You have to have them up if you want to lower them eventually.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And they're so low.
Yeah.
We have nowhere to go but up at this point.
And the very low interest rates have led to, I would argue, an overexpansion of business borrowing, which is a destabilizing factor.
Right. Corporate debt.
Correct.
Right. Wendy Patton, what about that? The housing market, it could fail us in other ways?
The housing market remains very important as the backbone of wealth for the middle class. What we have now is a deficit of affordable housing for this vast low-wage labor market. I think people tend to think that we have government programs out there that help the poorest people with housing. Unfortunately, less than one in four of eligible people get any assistance, and the supply of affordable housing is diminishing, especially in fast-growth areas like Columbus, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So we really have two economies we talk about. One is the sort of the standard economy of the middle and the upper class, but you do have this crumbling economy of this vast low-wage labor market where there's not enough affordable housing, where people don't have regular jobs, where they get enough hours to get the basic safety net services that we need. Although we do have health care, many people do not qualify for unemployment compensation, and we are very weak in our other safety net programs here in Ohio, like cash assistance and some of the programs the TANF could and should offer working people. That's the segment, a huge segment of the population that we need to worry about as we worry about a recession.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the what's going on with the housing market? It's interesting what's happening. I read an article in Yahoo Finance. It reported yesterday that shares of home builder stocks have been hammered. Existing and new home sales have declined sharply, the pace of home appreciation has declined for six straight months now.
It is starting to look like a top. One of the lessons that we learned in the last recession is that housing markets can decline. I certainly don't think we'll see the meltdown this time that we saw last time. But I do think that the very rapid appreciation that we've seen for a change in Central Ohio, I think that's going to come back to bite us to a certain degree.
The things are being overpriced, overvalued.
This is the first expansion, housing market price increase that I can remember, that Central Ohio has outpaced the nation in price appreciation.
And what does that – why is that a concern?
Well, it's a concern simply because when it gets when the prices get too high and then start to fall, you start to see mortgage defaults. You start to see people just priced out of the housing market that don't qualify for mortgages. It's a real problem.
I've talked with a couple of our real estate experts recently, and they were talking about how the cost to build the lowest, cheapest, decent housing is too expensive for low-income people now.
Yeah.
To even rent.
And certainly the tariffs, too.
The steel tariffs, right.
The steel tariffs, I guess there are lumber tariffs on Canadian lumber.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more expensive to build now. What you would consider to be affordable housing is costing people $700, $800, $900 a month. And as Wendy says, there are these programs, but they don't go nearly far enough, and they don't. There are these long, long waiting lists.
I wanted to talk, Wendy Patton, about this next biggest generation, the millennials coming up. They're in a much different position than the boomers were back in the day. They can't afford a house. They can't afford a car. They're not getting the wages coming out of there's a gig economy. They're not getting the benefits, the pensions, that kind of a thing. Long term, what are your expectations for an economy, even in Ohio, where we have a lower proportion, or where a lot of younger people move away, what does that effect does that have on the economy going forward?
I believe that in the long run, if the economy moved forward as you describe, we will see lower productivity and we will see less opportunity instead of more opportunity. But I do not see that the millennial generation wants less opportunity.
No,
I see great entrepreneurialism in that group. I see this is a group that values walking. They value the public sector. They value public spaces, public transit. They want to see the kind of investment that will allow them to be very productive within a very efficient and effective economy. And I think they're increasingly looking towards your local and state and regional government and federal government to provide that platform they need to swim upstream in what looks like it's becoming a gig economy and a low-wage economy.
But is government necessarily set up to do that?
Government has been disinvesting for a generation, but the millennials' parents and the millennials remember that there was a time that government was considered the beneficial platform that provides clean water, that provides nice parks and open spaces, that provides public transit. And I think the millennial generation appreciates the services and wants to see more services. If you remember, recently someone put out on the Columbus Internet a view of the city of Columbus with the subway system. And that went viral all over Columbus. People were talking about it. They said, this is the city I want to live in. I want to be able to not have a car. I want to get around easily. People understand the civic platform that government can and should provide when we come together. And I feel that that generation understands the need to invest.
But can we afford, Bill Lafayette, to provide that if that generation is making lower wages?
Well, we can afford what we can afford. We can afford public investment if we raise the funding to do it. You pay for what you get, and you get what you pay for.
And we are seeing tremendous income growth at the very top of the income scale.
Right.
That's really where the only income growth is.
Right.
And yet our public policies have made the choice to cut taxes there at the very top. We worked with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy this year to determine how much people of the top 1% who have gained most of the income over the last 40 years have gotten in tax breaks since Ohio started cutting taxes in state fiscal year 2006. About $40,000 a year on average for the top 1%. And that tax break was doubled by the federal tax break of 2017. So we're cutting off tax revenues at the very top where people should be paying their fair share from an economy they have gained the most from. And that's where we need to be looking for restoring our investment. Our corporations are tremendously profitable. We're seeing the corporations take last year's giant federal tax cut and do massive buybacks of stocks.
Right.
We are not seeing this flow to the middle class, to services, and to the kinds of things that our millennials need to create a future for themselves and their families.
And we're buying back stock instead of investing in plant equipment and R&D that would make the economy more efficient.
We'll continue the conversation about this stock buyback and what it portends. But for now, I have to say thanks and goodbye to Wendy Patton. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ann.
Wendy Patton is Senior Project Director at Policy Matters Ohio. Bill Lafayette, economist and owner of Regionomics LLC, will stay with us. And we'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the prospects for another recession and what happens when it hits. Still with us is economist and owner of Regionomics LLC, Bill Lafayette. Joining us now is economist at this conservative-leaning Buckeye Institute, Andrew Kidd. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We talked about this a little earlier, but I want to bring it up again with you, Andrew Kidd. An economist at New York University found that about half of American workers have not had a real wage increase despite the rising unemployment, or the rising employment, I should say. What's the balancing act between employment levels and wages? When are we? When do you think and when do you figure the United States starts to see some improvement on that score?
Well, we have seen wages growing very slightly recently.
Slightly.
Right, right. What we've had is a sluggish expansion since the Great Recession.
A long expansion, but a sluggish one.
Right, right. And we've seen that both in terms of inflation, too, though, which is why things have been relatively more affordable over this expansion period as well. But at the same time, if wages aren't growing to help those people afford those basic needs, that's problematic.
Why aren't they growing?
Well, part of it is when you think about total compensation that someone receives for a job, it includes the wage, but also includes all the benefits they receive. And some of those benefits are health insurance. And health insurance has been one of those things, especially health care, costs have been increasing over the past decade for sure. And they've been growing substantially over the past several decades. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that has been difficult to control for sure.
Mm-hmm. Bill Lafayette, you agree?
I agree.
A healthcare piece?
Well, healthcare is certainly part of it, but there are all the other benefits that people get. The thing to remember is you have so many people in the gig economy who, by definition, do not get benefits.
No pensions, no 401ks,
Yeah. You
know, that whole thing.
And the healthcare that these folks don't get might well be retarding the rate of entrepreneurial development, because it's hard to start a business without health care. Fortunately, I was able to get on my spouse's health plan, and so I had health care from the beginning when I started my business back mm-hmm. in 2011, but lots of people don't, and who knows how many businesses don't get started for
and
that reason.
The kinds of jobs are just lower paying. They're not not unionized, most of them. They're in the service economy, some of which are unionized, but the vast majority are not. What role does that play, Andrew Kidd?
Sure. I think what we're seeing is that some companies are starting to respond to this, though, with increasing wages for some of those individuals. You see this with companies such as Amazon, who now have almost a minimum wage for themselves. They set
at $15,
mm-hmm. which is a great place to start. And what we hope to see is that companies continue to increase those wages. The problem is that when you hire someone who's low skilled, there's a training aspect to it. And so you have to get them on board. You have to bring them up to speed. And it takes them a little while to get their wages growing again. But they really start at that low wage only for a short period of time. And once they are onboarded, once they're there, wages start to rise for them.
But these are in industries that are becoming automatized, automated, I should say, Bill Lafayette, are they not? So
indeed,
those jobs are kind of destined to go away.
You tour a major distribution center and you see more little robots running around than you see people mm-hmm. running around. And the thing that really worries me over the medium to long term is how this will impact the white collar workforce that's very prevalent in Central Ohio. I've said before, maybe being a little alarmist, that if we're not careful and we don't play our cards right, Columbus could look like Youngstown.
Because of AI?
Because
artificial intelligence?
Of artificial intelligence, because of the automation of more routine clerical functions that are now done by people.
Do we need a person to do an actuarial table? In other words, could a computer do the same thing?
Yes. A computer could design a house. I saw on TV a little while back a house being printed with a 3D printer.
Right.
And so there are all kinds of jobs that are really vulnerable. I don't know so much about economists. I'm a little worried myself.
Well, journalists, we know that they're AIs writing certain sports stories and that kind of thing, and business reports as well.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Is it something you're concerned about, Andrew Kidd?
AI is definitely something we want to be aware of. It's one of those things that we see happening right now at McDonald's, where they're replacing people who usually took your order with kiosks. And those are the type of low-paying jobs you were mentioning before that are kind of getting eliminated with the AI. Now, I wouldn't be as alarmist to say that we're going to see all jobs all of a sudden become automated. There is definitely the human element that is essential to the economy.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that all jobs will be, but enough jobs will be to leave a mark.
Hmm. And already have.
Correct.
You know, when GM announced that it was shutting down its Lordstown plant that would cost our economy 1,400 jobs, cost people, humans, 1,400 jobs, a lot lost in a lot of that was the fact that they'd already shrunk down from three shifts a day to one shift a day, costing the state 3,000 jobs.
I'm looking
over the last 2 years.
I'm looking deeply into that for an article that I'm writing for this Friday, and it was driven by consumer demand. The idea that people weren't buying Chevy Cruises, they were buying big SUVs,
right? Because of cheap gasoline.
Correct.
It goes back to that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
It's all connected. You know, what about the global economy? A column in Forbes recently concluded with this notion. Donald Trump will not be the author of the next recession, but his economic policies will both increase the severity of the recession when it arrives and as well as magnifying its global repercussions. Andrew Kidd, we are in a global economy. He has rejected very openly the that kind of multilateral approach to diplomacy and to trade issues.
Right. And his main concern is that, I think he states it, everybody's being unfair to America. Now, that's kind of an extreme stance to take, I believe. But that is what he's saying.
Yeah.
And he's doing that through tariffs. He's doing that through this economic tool that can cause more harm on other people's economies because of the fact that we're taxing them for what they're bringing in.
It's the stick approach versus the carrot approach.
Exactly.
And what does that mean when we're talking about not just a U.S. recession or a destabilization of the economy, but a global one?
Well, it's adding uncertainty for sure. And so we're seeing this in China. China's economy has been shrinking. We're seeing this in the EU and with Great Britain. And right now there's the Brexit deal that's still underway, is not finalized, trying to find a solution to. That's causing a lot of uncertainty, too. And that's motivated by similar motivations that Donald Trump has, which is to protect local workers.
Can you protect local workers, though, if you're destabilizing the rest of the world economy?
No.
Okay.
There are a couple points there. The first is that a little known aspect of the 2008 financial meltdown was that there were all these transatlantic credit swaps going on to help stabilize the European economy. And if we take this America first, go it alone approach, we're eroding those kind of relationships that were so instrumental in not making things worse last time.
You know, right, that Forbes writer I was referring to, Yua Hedrick Wong, is a former global chief economist for MasterCard and chair of the Academic Advisory Council for MasterCard for 8 years until this year. And he said that when the global financial crisis erupted a decade ago, coordination between governments and central banks across the world helped contain the damage. And that's what you're talking about?
Yeah. Indeed.
Exactly
indeed.
That. And that kind of coordination will be more difficult to attain today.
Yeah, very true.
Andrew Kidd, I mean, so what does that mean when – all right, so we don't have the housing meltdown that we had in 2008, which, of course, just wreaked havoc in Ohio. It was one of the first states to start to even show it. The Columbus Dispatch did stories, a whole series of stories on it before it erupted nationally. We do have more stability in our healthcare system, although there's some questions about whether there's going to be cuts to Medicaid expansion going forward, whether they're going to limit the expansion, not let people go in and out of it, that kind of a thing. But we have this global piece now to contend with.
Right, right. And I think what we kind of have to remember is there was that big housing market bubble that popped.
Yeah.
It's difficult to see what the next bubble is in terms of making the projections of when the next recession will occur. It's not as obvious, I think, what that bubble is this next time around.
We have a lot of people getting ready to retire, too. Most of their nowadays, I think it's a majority of their savings is wrapped up in the market in one way or another, whether it's a 401k or an IRA or whatever form it may take, or a pension. A lot of pensions are struggling. Now we have these big drops in the market. If I were retiring, in 6 months, I'd be really concerned. And what there could be like another kind of pullout of the market as well, because we're talking about the baby boomer generation, the biggest of all.
Right. And that
and we don't have it being replaced by millennials because they're not making any money and they don't have the resources.
Right. And they're busy paying off student loans.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So they can't invest.
Well, and I think it's as you're preparing for retirement, you're going to see a lot of people retiring earlier now before that happens. You're going to see people who are dropping out of the market, and that might generate the type of unemployment surge we might see leading up into the next recession. It might not just be the fact that we have working age people not working. It might be retirees who were in part-time jobs who were working dropping out just to avoid the type of contentions that could come with a
right, because
market.
They can start to access and tap into instead of have to just leave it there.
Right.
So what about the worries? I mean, I've tried to temper the conversation today. I don't want to be a fearmonger when it comes to the recession, but is there a way to prepare? Are there common sense things? We were talking about the unemployment compensation system, Andrew Kidd. What about that? The Ohio General Assembly has done nothing. They've had a lot of hearings, and we already know businesses don't want to increase their contribution, and labor doesn't want to take a cut in the amounts or the length of time of the compensation.
They have dropped the ball in terms of trying to fix this problem.
They're going to have to do something.
Mm-hmm. But there is steps that Ohio has been taking, and as much as Governor Kasich has been criticized one way or another for the tax cuts, what he's done is he's also filled up the rainy day fund, which is a great resource to have as we go into the recession, if a recession does occur. There also is he's created good budgetary standards of keeping a balanced budget.
By the Constitution.
Well, you look at places like our neighbors to the east or to the
west.
Illinois, mm-hmm. who have the same type of budget constitutional amendment, but they struggle to make it ends mm-hmm. meet year after
yeah.
year.
So those things bode well. Andrew Kidd, we're out of time, but I thank you so much for yours today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.
Andrew Kidd, an economist at Buckeye Institute, and also Bill Lafayette, as always, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Anne.
Bill Lafayette, economist and owner of Regionomics LLC. That's it. Thanks for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.